talking about having done a report on...
Yeah, on Carl Ziegler's work. And at that time, he was interested in trihalon methyls, and I got quite interested in those, and actually did a good deal of research on that my first two or three years later in the, when I was a graduate fellow, when I was an independent research worker.
I wondered where that interest came from. I knew it had, Gomberg had done that much earlier.
I was followed up through Carl Ziegler because I got interested in what he'd done, and that's also, he had made a compound which he claimed was a trimethyl benzyl ammonium, and I was got interested in trying to make that kind of alkyl amines, well, five R groups instead of four and a halogen, and that's the work I did led to the first synthetic polyethylene that anybody ever made. Nobody was interested in it then.
that was the when you tried to put five on arsenic, right?
I did it on the nitrogen and arsenic and phosphorus. I made the first ileids of phosphorus that later became vitics.
Reagent.
Mm-hmm. In that series of work with the arsenic, we got from lithium ethyl, we got byproduct of gas, and analyzed the gas and was ethane. And you can't write a reaction that makes sense to get all ethane. You ought to get ethane and ethylene or butane. But I had practically pure ethane with little ethylene in it. And that's when I postulated that the lithium had polymerized the ethylene. And so I made an experiment to show that it did and got polyethylene out of solution, but nobody was interested in polyethylene at that time, so we didn't follow it up. And that's why I missed having linear polyethylene to my credit instead of Carl Ziegler.
And then you had another sort of accidental
bromamines.
Yeah.
Made bromalkyl dialkylamines and they polymerized and gave linear products that had some ionic, some non-ionic bromine, and by comparing the amounts you could tell how big your molecule was. So I got a couple of polymers and got interested in them that way. And about that time I started being a consultant for DuPont, and Elmer Bolton said to me, here's a reference in the English literature to a reaction between sulfur dioxide and ethylene. Give a product which is polymeric. He said, do you think that reaction would go? And he said, certainly it's not orthodox. You wouldn't expect it. But if you're interested, why don't I try and see? Well, we couldn't work with ethylene because that's pressure, but we did use propane, butane. I worked mainly with cyclohexane first. And of course, you got a good product. I've been about 10 years working on olefin sulfur dioxide addition product.
And you were working on that when I came to Illinois?
Yeah, I worked on that for about 10 years, off and on.
And none of those polymers were ever useful polymers, but...
Until lately. Oh, now they're very useful.
Yeah.
In something, I forget what, but the Bell Telephone views them as a... Yeah, what is they using for it? Well, what you do really is to make a polymer and use it as a matrix to build other polymers around. And when you get ready, you can heat it and dry that out and have open places left where you had the other one in. So some of their reproducing processes, they use that now. So many years after we made them, they suddenly became useful.
I remember in one of these little notes you mentioned the fact that you tried to make poker chips out of them, and I wondered why in the world you wanted to make poker chips.
Well, because that's one of the easiest ways to test a polymer. The bowls are just the right size.
I see. Had nothing to do with your interest in the playing of poker.
No, I did play poker, but not that. That was just because that was the standard way of testing it. You've got beautiful, clear chips. As clear as methylmethacrylate chips. But always there was a star in them because they decomposed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just enough to knock them off. And we never could stabilize them. And so they never were useful as molding resins, but for a resin that you want to discard later, they were fine. Because they decompose completely and leave
volatile products. Yeah.
All volatile products.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back for a minute before we get on to that part of your curriculum. You became an instructor in Illinois in 1920.
Yeah.
Did you have it? Were there any other jobs available?
No.
You just.
No. Matter of fact, I took that job at I believe it was $1,800 a year. There was no other job available, and Oliver Cobb was supposed to be there. But before fall, he left, and they gave me a $200 raise before I ever started teaching. So I actually started teaching in 2000 a year. But the industry just was not hiring chemists at that time. Mm-hmm. It was right at the end of the war, and there were a lot of chemists that had been hired, and the industry hadn't really got started to beat it yet. So that jobs were extremely scarce in 1920.
Had you thought about doing anything else at that
time? Well, I always thought I'd be an industrial chemist.
I see. Was there?
Never had any other idea.
Okay.
But I didn't get it, and I never got around to do it to look until I was a little later.
There was already that orientation at Illinois, because.
Industry was always well thought of, I think.
I think that's interesting because most other institutions in the country, certainly the ones that I attended, most of the people would eventually go into industry, but you were certainly trained to be an academic.
I think that was characteristic of most schools, but Adams was always interested in industry. And
Leon went to Chicago and Harvard, and they were certainly oriented the other way.
But I think that we were. Well, my own students, I guess about 90% of them went in the industry.
How much do you think the PREPS program had to do with that, Steve?
It might have helped some, I don't know, but I was always a pretty practical-minded chemist. I didn't like to work on anything I couldn't see some use for.
I agree with that.
And that's what I always worked on. I'm a funny guy. I never wanted to do any research unless I was interested in it myself, and I was interested in useful things more than the others.
At that time, you certainly considered yourself an organic chemist.
Oh, yes. I was an organic chemist until about, after 1930, I began to be mainly polymer chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't any polymer chemists then.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what they were.
Yeah. Yeah. You did have some idea what you wanted to do. I know you already started to think about these trihalyl methyls.
Yeah, well, and, because I'd worked on that, had problems.
Yeah, and what other kinds of things did you want to do at that time?
Well, it was maybe drug synthesis. I looked at some of those, tried to make some things that would be useful. But I never got into that very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I made a lot of mercury compounds because I had some ideas in that field. And in fact, the first independent piece of work we ever did was a senior work with me to make organic mercury compounds, dialkyl mercuries. But I got so I was sensitive to mercury, and so I had to kind of get out of that. Somebody opened a bottle of mercury compound two doors down the hall, and I began to get a headache.
That's interesting, yeah. During that period, you must have already been aware of the work of Karasch, because he was also working on dialkyl mercuries.
Yeah, I knew Karasch's work.
Yeah. Come back to the general feeling about Chicago and Karasch.
He was a good chemist, although he was a very controversial one, always scrapping with everybody. Karasch was, I liked him, he's a good friend of mine, we got along fine, but Karasch was one of these fellows, if he listened to his talk, and he disagreed with something he said, he asked him a question, God, he'd be mad at you. He'd just rake you over the shoulders and make you feel like a horse's ass. But if you went to him privately, you could argue about anything with him, it was all right.
But
publicly, you didn't want to criticize him.
Uh-huh. I know there were some hard feelings, but I had the feeling that between Illinois and Chicago.
I wouldn't say it was hard feeling, it just wasn't much feeling at all.
I see.
Well, I had a few little arguments with Garage.
Well, you can easily argue with it.
I think I probably had a paper in which I may have disagreed with something.
He would get all nasty about it. Privately, you could argue with him and disagree with him all you wanted, but you didn't want to do it publicly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was very sensitive.
Yes, I think that's...
very sensitive.
But he was a very interesting guy to talk to.
Oh, yeah. He always gets some ideas.
Yeah, it's a good idea. He's a very bright guy.
How did he get on with Adams?
They fight back and forth some, but I think Adams respected his ability. I don't know whether he respected anybody else or not.
Interesting, sir. I think Adams was offered, was at least asked, he was interested in the chairmanship at Chicago in the late 1930s.
Most places was offered the job, but he didn't want to go.
Yeah.
He was offered one back at Harvard and didn't want it.
Yeah. Did you ever have any of these offers other places?
I had a place offered me in Minnesota once. I considered pretty seriously to decide and stay where I was.
Now,
and after the war, I had a chance to go to industry, and I almost did that. I'm glad I didn't. I had a chance to be research director first after the war years.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure I could ever get back into university work and, you know, get out of that. But I stayed on, so I was lucky.
Mm-hmm. When you first started, what were your duties as an instructor?
I taught the general course, organic chemistry, the whole events, the laboratory courses. I taught every course, I guess, I ever gave chemistry, but I forget it one time or another.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I shook down to allow that the second semester of organic chemistry for chemical engineers. It's my standard long time job.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any favorite textbooks during that period?
We used Norris a good deal as a reference book.
Norris?
Yeah, Jimmy Norris.
Okay,
From MIT.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That was I have made up my own lectures that I was my main background.
There was an odd position there. After you were an instructor, you became an associate, and then you became an assistant professor.
That's the rule of Illinois at that time.
That's what I did. That's what Harold Snyder did.
There were five positions.
There was an extra long in the line you had to get through in Illinois.
I don't think anybody's associate there.
Yeah. But that was a regular instructor, associate, assistant professor.
You went from instructor to full professor in 10 years' time, but you went up the ladder pretty fast, too. Was that fairly standard to go up the ladder fast in Illinois?
You were good like we were.
Oh. I was going to ask whether you knew somebody or it was just recognition of your abilities, but I think you answered that.
I'm sure it was, because there are some people who stay there as associate professor until they retire.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Tell me a little bit about Illinois during the 1920s. There were a lot of changes that were taking place.
In 1920 there was a lot of changes. In 1915 there were a lot of changes because they shifted the industry. We had a lot of people come in. The faculty shifted. A lot of went to industry.
Yeah.
We got a new man in physical chemistry, Rodebush. We got a new man in organic chemistry in Adams. We got the man who was head of analytical chemistry left, and Beale became in. The man who was head of inorganic chemistry was Balky, and Hopkins took over. And the chemical engineer, Paul retired, and Cotton Keys came in. There was a big turnover there.
Get those two names there.
Parr left from what we used to call industrial chemistry, and then industrial chemistry.
Four of those guys were still there when I came there.
But that was a new group that came in.
They were in
the
20s.
They came in the 15 and 20s. And then it was pretty standard after that. In organic, we hired a lot of instructors that didn't stay. Well, they kept those that we liked. Thought was going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
There was pretty good turnover in the structure.
I see.
For a year or two. That we didn't have the system that you had to leave after a certain time, but we generally managed it. If we didn't think they were going to be good ones, we'd find another job for us. Have to move on, think they were going up.
I see.
Kept good friends that way.
Yeah, an interesting approach. So, in 1920, the organic chemists were Noyes and Adams and Marwall.
That's right. And then we put on others. I can't remember. Denny's Souther, wasn't that his name? Denny's Souther.
Wasn't there when I was there, but I don't know him.
I mean, he was only there a couple of years. He wasn't one we thought we wanted to keep him.
Tucson and Schreiner came in there.
Tucson and Schreiner came in.
How late were they? I haven't checked.
Well, they
back.
Came in.
They were there in 36.
They
when
came
I got
about
there.
26 or 7, I think.
Okay.
Well, Carruthers and Jack Johnson were there.
That's right.
Yeah. So they left, and then we got several others, and finally we got you and Harold Snyder on. And then you left behind Bob Frank followed you.
Bob was on the faculty before I left.
Well, yeah.
I think Ellie there, Alexander, was the one who came to take my place.
Yeah, he died very suddenly, so we didn't have him very long.
And there was sort of a turnover in leadership in the department, too, in the mid-1920s.
Well, Adam became head of the department when he was retired.
Okay, was there... Was that
he was actually the boss before.
I see. So it was essentially, I mean, Noyes was sort of solely pushed out.
Well, he just slowly passed out. I mean, he got old and felt so active.
I see. It wasn't any sort of revolt or anything of that sort.
He just come to the end of his time.
I see. Okay. Let's see. I have a little note here that Stan Tarbell had told me that I think the first time that he came out to Illinois, he was looking around for Adams and he couldn't find him, and you were there, and you took him across the street for coffee at Farwell's.
Farwell's was standard. That's a meeting place for the organic.
Twice a day.
We never had a faculty meeting, as far as I know, in organic chemistry while I was there, except as we sat around the coffee table at Farwell's to talk things over.
Imagine who was going to pay for it.
Yeah.
we always
had to.
I had to pay for the coffee.
It was a heads up.
And when they had a visitor, we always managed to stick the visitor.
We
made it look honest. We always stuck the visitor somehow or other.
We were pretty good at that.
I see.
But that was a standard hideout.
Yeah.
In the morning and the afternoon, we all met there and had a cup of coffee. Lousy coffee, but it was a good place
good
to be.
Company.
Stan said it was lousy food. Nobody ever ate there.
No, the coffee was bad.
I see. Is that still
it's gone now.
Oh, it's wiped out.
There's some chemistry building in that corner now. They got their own coffee.
Since I was asking
a little bit about the new chemistry building. They still have the coffee station, but they have it in the building now.
I see. Not quite the same. Do you remember... Let's see, R.B. Woodward came out to visit for one summer.
He was an instructor for one summer.
Yeah.
He didn't like us, we didn't like him.
Okay. That was the impression.
He thought he was out with the Indians.
He
felt it was much below his dignity to work.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like to pay his bills either.
I think, that was one problem. The other problem was he was given an 8 o'clock class.
And he didn't like
and
that.
And he didn't like that at all. he rarely got there before 8:30 or so.
Oh.
And the other thing I can remember about him, he had the office right next to Harold Snyder. Harold and I were still finishing our year with Roger Adams that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob had the office right next to us, which Sam Gurnan had when I first got there. And Bob liked to smoke cigarettes, but he didn't like to buy cigarettes.
He didn't like to spend any money.
Harold Snyder provided him with cigarettes for quite a while until Harold finally figured out how to how to stop that. You know, I don't know whether you remember, but Harold kept a private pack of cigarettes, and the one on the desk had only one cigarette in it. And Bob would come in and look at the cigarette. He didn't quite have the gall to take the last cigarette. So he'd go out kind of muttering, and Harold would go and get his other pack of cigarettes out of the cigarette.
Well, he was a very disagreeable person as a colleague at that time, because he was unhappy out there. He didn't like it.
Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you,
and he wouldn't pay his poker debts.
That hurt some feelings out there. But
he wanted to go to look at the liturgy once. I owed him enough money to go, and he damn near never paid me back. And I never did get it back until he went east, and I fussed about to Adams, and he fussed to Jimmy Norris. Jimmy Norris
Jimmy probably paid him off for it.
Well, no, he made Woodward pay.
Well, later, Woodward, when he got really established himself, became a very different guy.
He grew up.
He grew up. He was just a kid. He was very young. He got his degree very young. And he was just damn arrogant about it.
Yeah,
he was amounted to at that point. But his daughter later came to Penn. I used to see a lot of Bob Woodward, and we got along just great. I got to be very good friends with Bob, but he had mellowed by that time, and it was a great. I enjoyed Bob.
Well, he was a very smart boy. There was no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's just that he didn't fit into the
Illinois.
He didn't belong out there.
It was not the right place.
It was way out in the woods, sticks for him.
Yeah.
Indian country.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, getting back to chemistry, during the 20s, who were the people you were talking to? Again, who were the people you were reading? Who did you think were the influential organic chemists?
The people who were most worked with, I guess, would be Whitmore and Lee Smith, Minnesota. Coleman, of course. Gilman.
Homer Atkins. Wisconsin.
Yeah. But that was the group that we were closest to. We used to trade students with all those people. We had a good horse trading set up.
Yeah.
We'd give them somebody, they'd give us somebody. We'd tell our students where to go. We couldn't get away with that nowadays, but then we could.
Did you know Kohler at Harvard?
I always knew who he was, but I never met Kohler.
Mm-hmm.
I never went to meetings.
Yes, that's what I know.
I never met him, but Adams was a great admirer of Kohler, and I heard lots about him from
him. He was a great teacher,
no doubt about it.
Very good. His lectures were
excellent. I've always heard that. And if you ever talked to a Harvard man and discussed chemistry with him, and he disagreed with something, he'd say, "Well, Professor Kohler says it this way," and my God, that was the end of the argument.
Well, you know, Kohler was a friend of Illinois. He sent me out there.
Yeah,
and you take that to be friendly, anyhow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he gave us a lot of good recommendations.
He
didn't recommend anybody that wasn't good.
I had a conversation with him. Roger was on the fellowship committee, the National Research Council, and seen my name, and he called Kohler. And said, would Kohler talk to me about coming to Illinois? And I went up there, and I never even, that time, you know, I was wet behind the ear. I never heard of Roger. I said, finally wind up, Kohler told me to go to Illinois. You go. That was the end of it. That's all there was to it. You didn't argue with Peter Kohler.
No,
he was
pretty straight.
And he knew what he was doing. He was a good guy.
I knew him that way, but I didn't know him personally.
I never regretted that decision. That was one of the best things that happened to me, telling me to go to Illinois.
Well, I don't think there was ever any school that was better to its students than Illinois was in those days. We knew our students very, very well. It was very close interplay between faculty and students. Everybody thought we had a factory, but we knew more about our students than most faculty did.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you first started on the faculty, you had undergraduates doing research.
Yes, mainly.
When were you allowed to take graduate students?
About two or three years after I started. Not only allowed to, I was forced to. Adams got sick, and I had to take all his people and all mine one semester.
Oh,
27 people working with me once a year there.
My. That was early on when you were...
Yeah, it was two or three, 4 years after Gustav Edelman, somewhere in the early times. And that was a rough semester. But he was ill, and I had to look after his people as well as mine.
Mm-hmm. How were the graduate students supported, for the most part?
Practically all on teaching assistantships.
Mm-hmm. There was
we had a few fellowships, and gradually they developed a lot of fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
But the beginning was all teaching assistants. And I think everybody went there started with undergraduates. Undergraduate research and then gradually shifted to the senior or the graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
When Howard and I started, we hadn't seen the first couple of years.
Research, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The first graduate student I ever had was one that Speed wanted to work with Speed, and Speed had a full group, and he says, "You go talk to Charlie Price." I remember the very first graduate student I had. And that was another very wonderful thing about him. The way they help the young, not only their students, but they help their young faculty that way.
See, they got going.
And, all the students wanted to work with the big names when they came there. And but Roger and Speed were very good at pushing these fellows off to work with us, and it would give us a very good start. And that was very typical of Illinois.
Well, we got along well. Never while I was there any feeling of friction between the organic staff with one another. Nobody ever tried to cheat in on that.
How did were the graduate students come around and talk to the various faculty?
They were supposed to do that, yes.
Okay.
They generally made up their minds ahead of time, but they were...
Yeah, they would come there to work with Adams and Marvel, They were the big names, and they were why they came there.
So we insisted they talk to all the others.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would push him off on us in addition to not really talking to us. I mean, some places, everybody's out to grab students.
Right.
We had plenty of students that we tried to see that everybody had a chance to develop.
One of the great features of Illinois.
Well, I think you've sort of given me the answer to this one. Certainly Illinois, for a long time, was the largest producer of organic chemists in the U.S. And I don't know, can you give me some impression of how that program was built? There must have been some decisions made at some point.
I don't think so. It was just attractive. The people came there and they liked the organic group.
Mm-hmm.
The boys that we used to get there were hungry boys. They were mostly from the small schools and the farms. They wanted a better living than they'd had there.
I see.
That's what got them into chemistry. Matter of fact, we used to have the best students at the university, and we were in Dutch all the time with the faculty committee on fellowships because we got the major share of them. But it was because our students had the best grades. We just had good students, wonderful students.
Did that start before Roger Adams got there with Noyes?
Not
start
so much.
That, or Roger was
Roger's
the main.
The one that drew
really,
he drew a bit. There's no doubt about that.
Now he was really very fresh out of
two or three years experience before he came to us.
Yeah.
But you two both established great rapport with faculty at other places.
We trade students.
And all the small colleges in the Middle West. And I know Michigan, just all kinds of small colleges up there was a regular pipeline to Illinois. So somehow or other, you two guys got...
Well, we liked the faculty, we liked the kids, and we took care of them.
And that's why people kept sending them back to you.
Sending them back because we took care of them. We liked them.
But it was amazing how many schools were just always sending their best students to come to Illinois.
In Ohio and Wisconsin, Indiana, all those people, Iowa, the small colleges sent their good students to us.
That was my question about how was the program maintained, and that certainly is.
And as a matter of fact, as time went on, we got more and more industrial fellowships. By the time you were there, nearly all of the third year people had fellowships.
Yeah. But they all taught when they first came.
Yeah, they all taught starting.
Which I thought was that's something I learned there, and I always tried to.
Nearly all of our teach at least one.
Yeah, I thought that was
experience.
Extra good experience. And, you know, that was a policy that I adopted both places I became chairman, because I thought it was a very, very good idea. It was one of the reasons your students were so good, is that they learned no way to learn like teaching.
That's right.
Two things you learn. You learn chemistry, but you also learn a little bit something about how to get along with people.
That's right. You've got to do the right thing.